Back in 1974, Spokane hosted the World's Fair. Expo 74, it was called. The fair was environmentally themed, and there was this IMAX video that showed at the fair. You can actually find it on YouTube now. And it starts out with these beautiful, soaring landscape shots. Canyons and forests and rivers. But then, it starts to take a turn. Suddenly, there's this crazy sped-up sequence. Cars are zipping through traffic. People are crowding into subway stations. You can hear how frantic the music is. Machines are digging through huge piles of garbage. It feels like everything is just spiraling out of control. And then the narrator starts talking about the dying animals.
There are only 50 whooping cranes left on the whole earth. Without room to breed, they're dying out.
It really makes you feel helpless. But then there's another shift. You can kind of hear it in the music. And the narrator says,
"We're the problem, but if we put our minds to it, we can also be the solution."
At this point, you're supposed to feel like, hey, there's hope again. Maybe something can be done. But at the same time, after all that you just went through, you kind of can't help but wonder, how much control do you really have? That's the lingering question for the people in today's stories. Welcome to Tales from the Fair, a special edition of The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Jessica Robinson. We're bringing you a series of short stories commissioned by the Spokesman Review, read here by the authors themselves. The authors were asked to write on the theme of the fair, and as you'll hear, the fair is a place designed to make you lose control. You'll meet a couple who's never the same after a ride on the Tilt-A-Whirl, and a mom searching for her lost child. But first, writer Leah Satilli has a story set in the strange netherworld of a real-life rap duo called Insane Clown Posse. And just so you know, fans of this group are known as Juggalos. Here's Leah.
Benji's pockmarked green Geo Metro, the one with glittering rims on the front wheels and donuts on the back, announced their arrival, rocketing a storm cloud of brown into the air above the dirt fairground parking lot. Dust mixed with the aroma of deep-fried Twinkies and cotton candy. Tiny, already queasy from the bumpy ride, turned her face toward her open window and breathed in the familiar fair smell. Around them, South Hill families piled into cars with four good tires that slowly crunched across the gravel, back windows filling with the wide-eyed faces of children peering out at the greasy people painted like clowns. As they passed, Benji, a swollen cherry in his red Hatchet Man jersey, his face painted so white it looked like his goatee had been dipped in frost, cranked up the stereo until the speakers crackled. Everyone knew the fair changed at night, that in the dark it belonged to the clowns. All around them, their face-painted brothers and sisters, juggalos and juggalettes, streamed into the fair gates, toting face-painted kids on animal backpack leashes. Young Lowe's waddled in the lot, pants sagging inches off the ground. A young blonde juggalette, who'd been boosted to the top of a green porta-potty next to the front gate, called out, "woot woot," from her post and flipped her tank top up to reveal breasts painted like clown faces. The metro lurched to a halt in what Tiny was almost sure was not an actual parking space. Her stomach gurgled at the sudden stop. Benji and Tiny's doors squealed in unison as they opened and slammed again with a bang. The pair rested their butts on the hood, Benji lighting a cigarette, Tiny popping the top off a tall bottle of cheap cherry soda. The glittery back pockets of her jeans crunched against the rusting paint job. As the Spokane sky put the final touches on its late summer light show of pinks and reds, Tiny looked out at the silhouetted Ferris wheel, took a swig, and wiped the pink syrup from her lips. It felt like the perfect time to tell Benji that there was a tiny juggalo inside of her. As she opened her mouth, Benji hopped down from the hood and reached through the driver's side window, snatching a pot of white paint from the spent bags of zips and old smokes littering his dashboard, and dipped a finger in. He drew a long streak of white down the bridge of her nose. "Better put your mask on, girl," he said. "Every clown in town will be here tonight." After the last time, the cops nearly tore the front door off their family trailer and hauled that deadbeat off to county, her mama told Tiny to never, ever trust a man. It's not like her mama had room to talk. Tiny remembered more nights laying in their dark tin can trailer, afraid to switch on the lights and tip off the old creep that lived next door that she was alone again while her mama slammed tequila at the Jackson Hole. By the time she was 13, she'd found herself acting just like her daddy, chasing that warm, uneasy thrill that came with getting away, with tucking cheap wine and cough syrup under her jacket at the grocery store. She ran with boys who'd drink their prizes with her in the back of their cars with her afterward, and then kiss her rough. She'd take their wallets and slash their tires when the medicine made them fall asleep. Lately, Tiny had found a new thrill: getting caught. In the blur of red and blue lights and squealing sirens, her skin would prickle in anticipation for the moment when the cops would wrestle her to the ground. She'd fight a little when they did, but only so they'd hold her tighter. As they pinned her down, it almost felt like they were hugging her. Before the clowns would go in and buy bouquets of corn dogs and pose for old-timey portraits in their face paint, they'd pump their car stereos, LEDs jiggling their backsides in the headlights. Across the parking lot, streams of grape and lemon lime glimmered in the lights, Technicolor liquid streamers rifling into the night. From the rusty Honda CRX across the aisle, Insane Clown Posse's Miracles rumbled through the speakers. Benji hopped off the hood of his car, pulling Tiny by her waist toward him. His watery eyes had carved wet trails down through his mask of black and white. "Baby, I saw the pee test in the garbage. Figured it was our hookup after Tech 9," the big man confessed. "I didn't know how to trust you," she gurgled, pitching her face into his giant shoulder, his swollen belly squishing between them. "Don't cry, girl," he said, holding her out with straightened arms and pointing toward the crowd of juggalos streaming into the fair. "We got family to help us raise our little one. Don't you ever forget that." Before she could respond, a girl with fleshy sides protruding over the top of her jean shorts cackled in their direction. "Why are you messing with that crybaby, honey, when you could have a real juggalette?" She ran her hands down the side of her mountainous body. Tiny pulled her box cutter from her back pocket and lunged at her, a prize fighter at the bell. The fat girl squealed as she disappeared into the crowd, and Benji grabbed Tiny's arm. "Hey, hey, whoa, mama," he said, smirking as he took the blade from her. "Listen, you can't be acting like that no more." Benji fished a hand in the side pocket of his cargo shorts and pushed a paper sack into her hand. "Here, I got you this. You gotta chill, baby." Sniffling, she reached into the brown paper and pulled out a bottle of Dimetapp grape cough syrup. "It's kid's cough syrup," he said, grinning wide. "You know, better for the baby."
That was Leah Sottile reading a story called "The Night Belongs to the Clowns." A 2011 FBI report classified juggalos as a loosely organized hybrid gang, so not the greatest reputation. But Leah says she became fascinated by their fanaticism as a music journalist.
I think that anybody that feels like they need a tribe is really interesting to me. So I'm actually kind of I think I'm one of the few people that's like sympathetic to juggalos. Like, you know, I really do hate their music, but I think it's kind of this interesting human comment that we have this need so much for a tribe in our lives.
Leah Sottile is a journalist in Spokane. Her work frequently appears in The Atlantic and Al Jazeera America. Next up, if amusement park rides could talk, writer Gregory Spatz wondered if they would be all that nice.
The few times I have gone to an amusement park or ridden on roller coasters and this kind of thing, it was associated with some kind of romantic thing, but also something a little bit sinister.
Here's Greg with his story about power and the tilt-a-whirl.
"We don't mean to make you sick. We mean only to remind you of the essential rule of chaos to which all things in the universe are, or should be, subservient. Relax. You're safe in us. Safe as if you were in the bottom of a spinning teacup, but better and more comfortably accommodated, semicircular padded shell to contain you, safety bar across your lap. And much less likely to vomit than if you were on one of the newer thrill seekers rides, thrown to dizzying heights and spun at the end of a tether before being flung earthward at dreamlike, death-defying speeds, like some kind of amateur astronaut. Only slightly more likely to puke than if you were on a merry-go-round, primitive, gentle granddaddy to all spinning flat rides. You will want to control us, and to a certain extent, you may. Throw your weight from side to side, pull back on the safety bar, and maybe we'll stall at the outer edge of an orbit before snapping back suddenly on the next downward turn, spinning, before stalling again, stuck at some other point in the orbit. Our secret is in our essentially uncontrollable controllability, like life itself, like gravity, like love, like falling in love. No two trips ever the same, our inventor's motto. Also, a ride for the kids and the grandparents, his other motto. We offer a mild, gently whirling first kiss sensation meant to make you yell, "Wee!" and "What fun!" Not "Stop!" or "Oh God, let me off now!" So you come to us at the close of day. Our tired, spinning platforms sputtered down to a low idle, no longer moving, all seven seats empty, axles heated from the day's labor, seat cushions littered with popcorn and change and carnival tickets and lost rings and trinkets. The concert is over and the concert pavilion closing, spectators by the hundreds spilling out of the pavilion's main entrances and exits, heading for home, but not you. You and your fiancé and the friends, another couple, who introduced the two of you months earlier. You wind your way back through the fairgrounds for the rear exits along the dirt path at the fenced-in periphery, the same way you entered earlier in the evening. We saw you. We remember. Walking somewhat faster then, kicking up dust and eagerly passing a flask, the same four of you, stylish young men in blazers, women in summer skirts, intent on a good time, ready for your transformation at the hands of the one and only, the man in black, Johnny Cash, his final farewell tour, history in the making. But really, could anything have lived up to your expectations? Johnny Cash seen from the highest section of the pavilion, barely ant-sized and hunched beside the diminutive June Carter Cash, Jumbotron telecast of his sweaty head slightly out of sync with what you could hear up there in the nosebleed section. We understand. And now your concert is done, but your fun is not, your money not all spent, your willingness to be impressed or to impress yourselves upon one another not done yet, nor your appetite for what? Call it fun. Call it unfun. Call it diversion. Sky darkening to mauve velvet, two stars visible in the clammy, still hot air, smells of popcorn, cotton candy, fry bread, horses, pigs, mixed with cooling earth, diesel, and cut grass. Until you see us under the spectroscopic lighting, your favorite childhood ride, always your favorite. Hey, it's the Tilt-A-Whirl. I love the Tilt-A-Whirl. How could anyone not love the Tilt-A-Whirl? Operated by the walrus, mustachioed beanpole man from Saskatoon, a man driven by nothing if not his own internal cravings for constant dizziness, for a constant internal spin cycle of chaos, both controlled and uncontrolled in accordance with whatever few bills he might find in his wallet at the end of the day, the price of the cheapest liquor, proximity to an open bar, package store, vestiges of willpower, and the number of hours before his next shift. Slow-eyed, silent at the levers. Years he's been at this same job. Enough to know how to play us like the guitar slung around your hero Johnny Cash's shoulders. "No, man, sorry," he says. "We're done for the night. No, really, I'm closing down. Can't do it. Sorry." Watch his arms as he pulls a final lever, turns a key, the veins and sinews in his arms, the knuckles on his hands, each a refusal, a whitened and dime-sized denial, thickened with calluses, each saying, "No, done for the night," as he prepares to padlock the entryway. "But please," you say, "it's our favorite ride, and our friends are leaving tomorrow morning. It's their last night in town. They got married on a Tilt-A-Whirl. Come on." We knew you loved us. We didn't know you were a liar. But this is also okay. We're all liars at the fair. It'd make it so special, something to remember. And here come the dollar bills, the tens and twenties peeled from a silver money clip to match your silver watch, your silver flask, and flashed at the operator, making him salivate internally, hold out a little longer, calculate the risk, the loss, the time drunk. How much does it take, you say, flipping more bills at him? Just a 5-minute ride. Come on. Really? Even for 40 extra dollars? 60? 70? What possible harm could come of it? At last, the inevitable swish of skirts, sandal and loafer heels tapping lightly around our treaded walkway. What you could not have known. We are both controlled and uncontrollable, and your surrender to us is not only unconditional, but also dependent upon whosoever operates us. In the hands of a carny with a canny eye for chaos motion and an intuitive sense of basic geometry, we can spin and spin and spin and spin and spin some more. You wanted diversion? You wanted memorable? Feel as he subtly adjusts your forward momentum at the crest of one swell, stalls and accelerates suddenly for maximum backward velocity on the next descent, then stalls again on the incline to whip you back around the other way faster, faster again, the acceleration through the next peaks and valleys, the stall, the whip around until you're all done laughing, until the world is a sickening, unmitigated blur, and his hunched figure at the controls is a barely distinguishable fixed point at the edge of an ever-shifting event horizon, until your groans and cries reach his ears, and in response, he gives you more. More and more, not 5 minutes, not 10, he gives you what you paid for. Stalls and spins and accelerates until your eyes feel as if they've melted through the back of your head and the pit of your stomach is caught in your throat. Isn't this what you wanted? A ride to remember? All the way home, and for days after, you will not be sure of your footing. Nothing will stay where it belongs. The edges of sight dissolved, the core of reason gone wobbly on its axis. At home, she is longer than normal in the bathroom, much longer. No sound of puking, only the sink dripping into itself. Point, point, point. Wake in the middle of the night, sweating and uncertain to feel beside you and find her gone. Soon she will no longer return your phone calls, your fiancé. No lights on at her house, no car in the drive. The centrifugal force of whatever fate flung you together caused you to meet and to ride the tilt-a-whirl after hearing Johnny Cash sing for his final time in your hometown. That fate is now yanking you from the course of your intended future and all the subsequent spiraling over the hills and valleys of time. The easy glide you thought would comprise the rest of your years together and dropped you down alone. Because she learned a little too soon something essential and repellent in your nature that night, something she might well have adjusted to, learned to live with and love over time, but now won't, ever. She'd seen your insistence on having things your way, regardless of the rules or consequences, and your wish to control things beyond your control. In another life, the one you'd envisioned, this might never have become associated with nausea and dread for her, might in fact only have dawned upon her much later, reflected in the eyes of your needy, beloved children, and then might easily have been dismissed as whining, as asking for too much, always asking for too much, like the kid you were then, like the kid you still are, and always will be. She might have identified it then and said, "No, get it yourself." And smiled in your direction, shaking her head, but not now. Now she lives on the other side of the continent and is mostly satisfied, only distantly nauseated by thoughts of her mortality, the life that one day spins us to death, her new husband's incurable gambling habits. She will not ride the tilt-a-whirl, never again. She will not let her nieces or nephews or anyone she knows ride the tilt-a-whirl. She won't set foot on a fairground. For all of this, we blame you.
And it makes a fiery ring, bound by wild desire.
That was Gregory Spatz. The title of that story is Monologue for a Tilt-a-Whirl. Greg says a version of this actually happened to him at the fair in Memphis.
everything was shutting down, but there was a tilt-a-whirl, and we said, hey, let's ride the tilt-a-whirl. And the guy did kind of what this guy, it wasn't nearly as dramatic, but he was just sort of like, oh, really? I'm closing. Really? So he said, well, how about if we give you $10? And he was like, okay. And then he gave us this ride that was like, all right, stop already. And he wouldn't stop. Because I think he was really trying to, like, we'd done him a favor. We'd given him, like, $10 or something. So he wanted to make it good for us. But it was a little too good.
Gregory Spatz has a novel called Inukshuk and a book of short stories called Half is Happy. He's the director of the MFA Creative Writing Program at Eastern Washington University. Our final author is Beth Cooley, and she also had personal experience to draw on.
I was a nanny in New Jersey once, and I took the children to an amusement park, and I'd gone with a friend who was also keeping kids, and the little girl I was taking care of disappeared.
She was eventually found, but Beth revisits that helplessness in her story. Here's Beth.
Would the owner of a little boy in blue jeans and a black Myrtle Beach t-shirt please come to Northwest Aqua Comfort to pick him up? The loudspeaker crackled and shut off. Marissa dropped the deluxe Easy Bun back on the display table and quickly scanned the crowd until she spotted Rob. He was checking out knives at Silver Valley Hunt Supply. Asa wasn't with him. Rob caught her eye, smiled, and waved. Idiot! Hadn't he heard the loudspeaker? How many little boys in black Myrtle Beach t-shirts could there be at the Spokane Interstate Fair? I thought he was with you, Rob said, stuffing a commemorative buck knife back into its tooled leather sheath. No, he followed you, right after I got the cotton candy out of his hair. Remember? Where the heck is Northwest Aqua Comfort? Rob said. What the heck is Northwest Aqua Comfort? Marissa said, squinting over hundreds of heads. Where would he be likely to go? Not back to the livestock barn, that was for sure. The horned goats freaked him out royally. The cows smelled, and the row of baby pigs firmly attached to their mother made him cry, "They're eating her!" as he tried to climb up Marissa's legs. Not to the Ferris wheel, which stopped after two rotations to let him off. The other passengers booed and cursed until the operator told them to cool their jets and took Asa gently out of the car. Rob followed sheepishly, then the giant wheel wheezed back up to speed. Not to the midway, where a bigger kid clipped him on the forehead with a beanbag and the carny had inappropriate tattoos displayed in full color on his forearms. Maybe the chickens, Rob said. They scared him, Marissa said. The chickens scared him? Yeah, the ones with the umbrella hair. Marissa's fingers flicked over her head. Feathers, Rob corrected her. Whatever, he was terrified. But the bunnies, he liked those. Too close to the chickens, Marissa said. They were power walking through the food aisles now, looking for Northwest Aqua Comfort. Only elephant ears and kettle corn and juice stand after juice stand and that infernal cotton candy machine spinning pink cobwebs with the holding power of super glue. Three times Rob ran up behind a little boy in a black t-shirt. Every time Marissa knew, even before the kid looked up in wonder at the lunatic apologizing to his parents, that it wasn't Asa. She'd know her Asa from any angle. It's the Myrtle Beach t-shirt, she said. It's bad luck. Your mother sent him that shirt. It's still bad luck. It's a t-shirt, Rob said. Marissa had always hated Myrtle Beach, but it's where you went to have fun if you were vacationing within 100 miles of the place. The big day out was Myrtle Beach SC, with its stupid Swamp Fox roller coaster and the giant carousel where she never got to ride the horse she wanted, and the tilt-a-whirl where she always threw up afterwards, and the steamy heat and mosquitoes, and, when she got older, the boys with cigarettes and mullets chucking out her long blonde hair, her halter top, her shorts. Why'd we even come here? She asked Rob. Because fairs are fun. Once we find Northwest Aqua Comfort, we can keep on having a good time. Marissa didn't answer. Her gaze swept the fairgrounds like the Mine Lab X-Terra metal detector Rob had tried out not an hour ago. But she refused to look at her husband, Rob, who still kept his 4-H ribbons tacked up in the basement, who got excited about giant squash and exotic poultry. who believed in pickle canning competitions and tractor pulls. If all these people just weren't so tall and fat, like they ate elephant ears and Belgian waffles for every meal. Northwest Aqua Comfort! Rob smacked his forehead, his face lighting up as he remembered. He was off in a flash, shouting something over his shoulder. She thought he said, "Hot tubs." She flew after him and grabbed his arm. "You're going the wrong way. The hot tubs, they're back." She flung her arm behind her, and they spun off in the other direction. "We didn't want to move him," said the man in the orange barbecue apron and cowboy hat. There lay Asa, in the deepest valley of the largest hot tub on display, lured by the serene fiberglass geography, the smooth, dry steps and plateaus, the blue veils. Marissa crept closer. "The little guy's all tuckered out," added a woman with monumental blonde extensions and fingernails the exact same color as her orange barbecue apron. Northwest Aqua Comfort was embroidered across her chest. She winked at Rob. He coughed and blushed. "Asa," Marissa whispered and touched her son's cheek. Asa smiled in his sleep. Sitting carefully on the edge of the hot tub, Marissa kicked off her flip-flops, swung her legs around, and silently settled her bare feet on the cool plastic molding. Asa barely stirred as she slid down the tub's blue side and gently, gently curled herself around her sleeping boy.
That was Beth Cooley. The name of that story is Not Always Fun. Beth Cooley has two young adult novels, Ostrich Eye and Shelter. She's also a poet and essayist. Beth teaches at Gonzaga University. That's it for Tales from the Fair. This has been a production of Spokane Public Radio. These stories originally appeared in the Spokesman Review and were edited by Carolyn Lamberson. If you missed the three earlier episodes, I encourage you to go back and listen at SpokanePublicRadio.org. And if you want to devour the words yourself, you can find the original text of the stories at spokesman.com/longform. Look under Summer Stories. Oh, and in case you were wondering, there are now 600 whooping cranes, according to the International Crane Foundation. I'm Jessica Robinson. Thanks for listening.